Welcome to the Matt Haycock Show, a podcast about business, money, and life. Matt has been making money and making mistakes for over 20 years. And in this podcast, he shares his thoughts and stories so you can improve your business, finances, and life, whilst hopefully avoiding the mistakes he and others have made along the way. Listen in and level up.
Welcome to episode number 9 of my podcast. Now, if you've listened to previous episodes, then you'll know that lately I've been interviewing celebrities and business leaders to delve deep into their stories and extract nuggets of actionable tactics and strategies from them. Well, today the tables are turned and it's me that's going under the microscope. One of my previous guests, and someone you probably often see me talk about and mention on social media, is a very good friend of mine, a guy called JP de Villiers. Now, earlier this year, JP and I were on a skiing trip with a bunch of investors and other business people. And one afternoon, JP asked me if he could interview me and pick my brains. What better place to do it than the hot tub, I thought. So we jumped in the jacuzzi, we went live with his social media audience, and JP got the warts and all tales of my life from school to strip clubs to bankruptcy to rebuilding and everything in between. And today's podcast is a recording from that interview. So sit back, relax, turn up your radios and listen to my story so far and some of the lessons that I've learned along the way. Hey guys, it's Matt Haycox here and I'm here with JP de Villiers and we are in the hot tub in Merivale for what is going to be my most intimate interview to date. Intimate both in terms of the fact that we're touching toes in the hot tub and intimate in terms of I'm going to tell JP my backstory from being 12, 13, 14 years old through to where we are today. The highs, the lows, making money, spending money and losing every fucking penny of it and starting all over again. So I hope you guys like the story. Also, just to set the scene, while JP's talking to me, we're going live on Instagram, we're going live on Facebook, so we're going to be answering some of the people's comments, we're going to be talking to these guys here, talking to you guys a bit up there, so don't feel distracted, and I hope you enjoy the interview, and thanks a lot for doing this, JP.
Thank you. So, Matt, first of all, thanks for having this conversation with me in the hot tub. You know, let's not going to beat around the bush, let's say it straight as I always do. Matt has invited me here on an annual networking event, or networking experience, not even an event, and we're in Merivale, France. I've never been here before. As you can see, it's absolutely stunning here. So first of all, Matt, thank you so much for having me.
No, thanks for coming. We've been saying to everyone every day, we've only been here one day, we've only been here 2 days. I think we're on our third day here now, and I think the relationships people have made with each other, we've got eight or nine people with us. Right. A couple of people have changed, but you know, some fantastic bonds, some great creative juices flowing, and it's been a pleasure having you and everybody else.
Yeah, I'm lucky to be able to work from wherever I want, so I'm here for the whole week, but one of the guys, Sav, who's probably going to be watching this, had to leave after one day, and the connections have been so good. Everyone was really sad to say goodbye to him.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's crazy. I mean, you know, most of us met, well, obviously I knew everybody, but I don't think anybody else here had met anyone else before we arrived. And we met in the airport at, you know, 9:10 o'clock on Sunday morning. So Sav, his last night, effectively, was Monday night. So he was with us for 36 hours. I mean, literally 36 hours. And by Tuesday lunch, people already said, oh, if Sav was here for this, or if Sav was here for that. So, I'll always talk to people about, you know, trying to create great experiences where you can build a better bond than you would in the office environment or in a coffee. But I know people might watch this and think, oh, look, you know, these guys are in Merivale. It's aspirational. It's expensive. And yes, it can't beat around the bush. It is. But for me, experience and budget aren't necessarily intrinsically linked. You know, you can do some fantastic relationship building experiences on any budget, you know, whether it's no budget, minimum budget or mega budget. So, you know, please don't, you know, look at this and think that you guys can take it away and definitely make use of it, not, oh, you know, these guys are doing it because they're sat in a hot tub in Merivale.
Yeah, if anything, it's very well put. If anything, it's not, oh, I wish I could do that. It's how could I do that using the resources that I have. And actually, before we continue, Matt, that. We haven't even intro'd you yet, and we're already getting stuck in. You've actually really inspired me. I didn't come here for anything other than to be present. And you made me realize that even though I run events and I have really good connections, never in 15 years have I ever taken my connections and said, I want to take you away. Just come hang out with me. Let's go do something cool. Never in my career have I done that. So I want to thank you. I never say that I'm the best. I never think that I'm a know-it-all. I'm always looking to learn in business, in personal development, spirituality. And one thing that I've taken away and committed to is over the next year, finding an experience like this that works for me and my people, and inviting them along. Who knows, maybe you'll be there.
I hope so.
If you take the invitation.
I hope to be setting your hot tub somewhere else in the world.
So first of all, let's just do a quick intro. Matt Haycox is in the investment world. I told you he's an online influencer. He's not an investor, but he helps and invests in people who need help in their business. And it's actually very inspiring what he does. But what's more inspiring, and actually what really engaged me in wanting to have this conversation with Matt, is his story. It's a hell of a story of success, of fame, of even debauchery, of failure, of failure and failure and failure. He's just done so many things, and he's been through, more importantly, so many things. And here he is. You know, I'm always saying, whatever you've been through, you've been through. If you hadn't been through it, you wouldn't be here. So I really just want Matt to just, you know, share a bit about yourself. And you know, people can obviously go online, but more importantly, share, you know, your story and what's it been like and what's your life been like. I'm inquisitive to know more, because I only know that much.
Well, I officially started a business, you know, when I was 18, 19 years old. But I guess
what was that?
That was working in a family corporate clothing company at the time. But just to kind of predate that a bit. I mean, I was always interested and hungry within business, and you know, I mean, I know nowadays it's very fashionable to have a rags to riches story of, you know, I was on the streets and then I made a load of money. I'm not going to pretend for 1 minute that was my story.
Appreciate your honesty.
But my dad was a very successful businessman, completely different space to me. But he had an IT company. And we're very different characters in the way, I guess, in the kind of deals we like and the kind of business mentality we have. But I'd always been, I'd always spent time going to his office, going to his events, and just been hungry to be immersed in that kind of stuff. Networking back then was probably a different thing to what it was now. But I mean, I'm 37, 38 now, so I remember when I was 10,
yeah,
11.
Same age.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Oh, well, you're looking at me thinking I'm 10 years older.
Yeah.
Cheers.
Well, no, I mean, because of what I see you've achieved, that's a huge compliment.
Well,
anyway, continue.
He's backtracking. What he means is because I'm not
in
shape like this guy.
He's burned.
These are sunburnt eyes, not tired eyes.
No, he's burned from a hard knock life. No, he's burned from skiing. Yeah.
No, but I remember when I was 10, 11, 12 years old, my dad would put on, let's say, you know, sales events at the house where, you know, back in those days it was Tom Peters. Do you remember Tom Peters?
Yeah.
So we had the Betamax or the VHS, and he put the Tom Peters video on. Six or seven guys from his sales team had come and watched the video, and for me, I mean
wow.
This sounds normal now, but you know, but back then I think that was, I mean, personal development probably didn't even exist as a word, and you know, and investing in your staff was, you know, certainly not the norm. But I used to consume, you know, consume information back then. Always knew I wanted to be in business, and I guess, you know, I think you hear a lot that people from more successful family backgrounds, you know, don't have the drive and the whatever, yeah. And it's the guys who have come from nothing that, you know, that perform better. Listen, whilst I came from a good background, I'm also, you know, clear to say that my parents never invested in any of the businesses I did, but I guess I just had a nice background to be around, and I've always just been hungry, so fucking hungry to make money, not because, you know, and again, I'm not going to put a romantic slant on it. I like money and the things it can bring, and you know, and whether that's for me, for my family, for helping other people. I just want to earn it. So I've always been hungry from a young age, and I remember I was actually having a mini interview with someone a couple of weeks ago, a guy who's in the copywriting space. Yeah. And it's so long since I've actually seen any copywriting, but when he started to show me his content, it took me back like literally 20 odd years to when I was 13, 14. I'd read every local newspaper where in the back it was like, you know, buy this course and make a million. I was telling this fellow that I subscribed to so many of these mailing lists that, you know, as a 13-year-old kid, I got more mail at the house than my parents were doing. And none of them worked, but, I just tell it as a story.
Matt, sorry, man, before you continue, because you're just dropping bombs here, I just want to share something. First of all, I always talk about the fact that there's exceptions to every rule, right? So a lot of the times when I talk, when I coach, etc., I'm generalizing a lot of the time. But here's proof that there's exceptions to every rule. And it's cool to think that you are an exception to the rule, because the rule states that if you had a hard upbringing, you're more likely to be successful. And if you had it comfortable, then you won't have that drive. So once again, just remember that there's rules in life, but there's always exceptions to those rules. And the second thing is, it'll come to me. There's something about you being so driven, but yeah, please continue. So, you've always had the drive.
I guess all through my education as a childhood, I was adamant I was going to quit school as quick as possible to go out and work and earn money. I won't pretend I had an idea of what it was going to be. I just, I wanted to try things. And my parents were very much of the kind of era of education mindset. My dad, because he'd been to university, I think, from memory, he was like literally the first person, because he came from a very poor background in a poor town, and he was the first person in his year group to ever go to university. So I think obviously it was something that he believed in, and my mom never got the chance to go to uni, so they used to drive on me since I was, since I could walk. You're going to uni. My mom was very much into, you're going to be a doctor, or you're going to be a lawyer, and you've got to do this education. I just never wanted to do it, not because I didn't believe in it. Obviously I've formed my own views on that kind of thing now, but back then I just wanted to get on and make some money. I remember at the time my dad sold his business in 1998 or 9, when I was effectively just 18, just about to leave school. And I managed to convince them that I was going to take a year out as a gap year. I would go off and make my millions, and therefore never need to go back to uni. But if it all failed, then my gap year would have been a working gap year, if you like, and I'd have had to go back to them with my tail between my legs. But at the time, my dad, he'd sold his business, and he was looking for a couple of things to get invested in, and he found a corporate clothing business in the UK, and in Leeds, and I'll tell you the exact figures, to put this into context. Yeah. At the time, this was a business that was supposed to be very successful, strong customer base, been a family business, a two-generational family business, where it was having a slight struggle and needed a 30 grand investment to basically get it over the hump. So my dad put the 30 grand in, was supposed to go on there as a non-executive director, sit on the board in some capacity. And I got him to basically allow me to go work there in sales. So so the start of my gap year was that I was going to learn sales and learn what goes on. No, in Leeds actually, in Leeds. Right. Learn what goes on in this business under his tutelage, if you like. So I'm working in the corporate clothing business, and it was it was just a fucking disaster. There's no other way to put it. This business that was theoretically, everything was perfect. We've got bubbles.
It wasn't me.
So this business where everything was supposed to be tickety-boo was a disaster. Suppliers wouldn't deal with us because they hadn't been paid for so long.
Hence why they were where they were.
Yeah, it was misrepresented at best. The customer base was declining because the service had been so shoddy, the staff morale was through the floor. And my dad's 30 grand became 60, became 90, became 150. But he, and listen, this isn't putting him down, just was what it was. His attitude was almost one of laziness at that point. He'd worked solid for 25 years, 7 days a week for 25 years, built a successful business, sold it for a load of money. And his attitude was, I'm having a rest at the minute. Yes, this is consuming some cash, but I can swallow the cash, if you like. I just can't. No. I can't take any more stress. I was young, hungry, and 18, coming back home every day for 1 week, 1 month, 3 months, and I'd sit around the dinner table with my parents. I'd be like, "Guys, this is fucking ridiculous. No. You know, you're having the piss taken out of you. You know, we're losing our money." And my mum used to rib my dad and say, "Come on, just, you know, let Matt do something with it," and not because I particularly had a great idea, other than the hunger, A, to prove myself, and B, to stop the family's money getting dissipated. So one day, after a few months, my dad turns around and he basically says, "You know what, whatever, you can't fuck it up any more than those guys have done. Go in, do what you want, not it's yours, but you know, you can be the head of the business." And
when were you 19 now?
Oh yeah, 18, 19, it'll have been probably the early part of 2000. So I went in the next day and fired everybody. I mean, when I say everybody, maybe remain one or two people mm-hmm. remained. There were a couple of loyal, you know, warehouse members, etc. But as far as the management team, etc., was concerned, everybody went, and we started from scratch the next day.
That was a family business, right?
There was a brother, there was a sister that had at some point been a dad.
Yeah. Were they working in the business?
They were still working in the business then, but to be honest, they were the problem. And obviously, the attitude comes down from the top, and it was very difficult. It was just easier to clear the decks. Yeah. So we started almost like a fresh overnight. So my metrics for this business, if you like, were, when I took over it, it was probably losing 300 grand a year. We had no customer base or a completely declining customer base. So what we did was we created a new structure, rather than doing big contracts, because we used to do big things like a Arriva bus company or Metroline bus company, big annual contracts where they were nice if they worked, but you know, when you lose them, your top line's fucked.
Yeah.
So we started to move to niche markets, security, transport, nursing, healthcare, you know, where we do a higher number of lower value customers. We built the sales team from scratch. We had a new product base. I had to go out to a new supplier base and basically, you know, beg and grovel for them to supply us or to give us credit. And over the next 2 years, you know, we basically restaffed up, rebuilt, and by probably 2002, the business was turning over a million and change, and making 30 or 40 grand a year profit. Mm. And whilst, you know, especially in today's numbers, they're not wow figures. Yeah. You know, it's a story. For me, the story was, I had an absolute load of shit that was losing 300 grand a year, and I was thrown in at the deep end with every possible problem you could imagine. It was a real baptism by fire. And by the time, you know, 2 years later, we'd stemmed the losses, you know, got an engaged staff base, got a growing customer base, and I guess it was the foundations of a half decent business at that point. And then for me, that was my kind of platform to then move on, because I was, I guess there's no politer, but I was bored. You know, I think what the business needed at that point was management and structure and discipline and stuff. Yeah. And being honest, they're not really my qualities. Yeah, you know, yeah. I'm more into the cut and thrust of doing the deal, yeah. of seeing a problem, of fixing the problem, of, you know, connecting people, whatever it may be. And I basically stepped out at that point. My old man got back involved, and I'd made a little bit of money from that and from some things I was doing at the time. So I kind of set on to find my way, and at the time then I wanted to be involved in leisure, you know, bars and clubs.
Before we move on to leisure, first of all, I'm just taking nuggets here the whole time. Hey,
Shan.
Shaheen. So first thing, I remember what I was thinking before, which is your drive came from your environment. In his particular case, it was his role models, right? I wasn't fortunate enough. I love my family. I'm very grateful for my mother and everything that she did, but I wasn't given that, right? So you were given that by your environment. That's why it's important to always remember that who you're spending time with, who you're surrounding yourself with, including your parents, is affecting how you go out there and how you perform in business and life. That's number one. Number two, I want you to just share with you a kind of note that based on Matt's story, just remember that it doesn't matter how bad you're failing, it doesn't mean that you've failed. Your business or whatever you're going through can still be turned around. But sometimes the reason why it's failing is you, the owner. sometimes why I'm failing is because of me, the owner. So sometimes you have to get, you have to use his example, and you have to get the owner out of the way,
yeah,
or the person that's been running.
I think I'll probably go one step further on that thing. To, you know, JP says, you know, sometimes it's you, the owner. For me, every time is you, the owner, because as the owner, you know, you're there at the top of the organisation, and everything that goes on below you is ultimately, yeah, down to your fault. So you can say it's the sales guy that's fucked up, or the operations team that have made mistakes or let you down, but ultimately you as the owner are the ones that put them in place, that allow them to do, you know, to do what they're doing. So as a business owner, the first thing you have to do before you decide you want to be in business, or when you're in business, is are you ready to take 100% responsibility for absolutely everything you do? Because even we can say that the economic climate's changed, the banks have lost liquidity, our main customer's gone bust, therefore it's not my fault, my business has been a side effect of a problem, but I think you will always, any problem that has happened externally, there'll always be a way that could have not been the case if you'd thought that far ahead. So I mean, if your business is dominated by one customer that goes bust on you, then ultimately that's your fault for not identifying that earlier in the game and making sure that you've got a wider customer base that you're not going to be so reliant on. If you're a business that is reliant on debt to grow, then you don't want to be reliant on one particular funder. And you can take that theory further down the line.
Amazing, thank you, man. Just so much value. Onto the leisure.
Onto the leisure.
So Matt now moves into leisure.
So I move into leisure because I wanted to work in bars and clubs for no other reason than I was probably 21, 22 at that point. And we all want to work in bars and clubs because for sure that's going to make me a load of money and meet me a load of girls. And I won't pretend there was any more economic certainty than that. You know, I was going to have the most successful nightclub in town and meet the future ex Mrs. Haycox. I actually started with pubs. I met a friend again on a networking thing, actually, when I was still involved with the corporate clothing company. Yeah. Our bank took us to Boston in the United States with about 25, 30 other businesses and their bank managers and a few thought leaders who were doing keynote speeches and educating us on our individual businesses. I met some good contacts there. One of which was became a long-term friend of mine who was a pub landlord in the concept of owning the properties, not pulling the pints. And I convinced him to, I say convinced him, he told me he had a couple of pubs that he would rent to me because they didn't suit him anymore and they were perfect for me. Obviously what he meant in hindsight was they were absolute shite. And I was taking a big problem off his hands. But I was running some pretty rough and ready community pubs for another year, 18 months. And, you know, to varying degrees of success. I mean, again, you know, not one of them was going to make me a fortune, but some were all right. So, you know, some were a little bit less than all right. But what I realised at that point was that I needed ancillary income other than just beer sales. Yeah. So, and again, you know, whether that was food in a restaurant, door money in a nightclub, or some other kind of income.
Yeah.
And in my leisure life, as in my personal leisure life at the time, I was a pretty prolific visitor of lap dancing clubs, which again, being a 22-year-old customer of a lap dancing bar, deemed that qualified me to know how to run one. So I kind of went off knowing that if we had a lap dancing bar, I wouldn't just be selling beer, I'd be earning money from the customers who walk through the door, yeah, and the girls who work there would be paying me a cut of their wages. So that was going to be the answer to my income crisis.
So you've gone from one revenue stream up to three.
Exactly, yeah. And revenue streams that were much higher margin.
This is very important, guys. This is very good stuff.
So I went off and decided I was opening a lap dancing bar.
I love your honesty, by the way.
So created... created a brand called Wildcats, which and I guess the reason I felt that my brand would be different and I would be better suited in that place. I mean, bear in mind, we're going back at this point to 2003, 2004, when lap dancing was pretty much in its infancy in the UK. You know, the Spearmint Rhino had just come to England. Obviously, Stringfellow had always been a household name from his nightclub days for ages. And it always had those undertones. You know, it was not socially acceptable. You know, it was run by gangsters, etc., etc. And I'm not saying this is what it was, but they certainly were the perceptions. And I felt that as a young guy, as a genuine businessman, etc., that we could probably bring a new dimension to things.
So how old were you now when you started to go from pubs to lap dancing clubs?
22, 23, because the first club. I found a premise, and actually this is a true story, but one to follow with caution is after my corporate clothing days, etc., I probably had a couple of hundred grand of savings, if you like, and I'd done a couple of little house projects and things at the time, so that was my capital pot to go and move on with. And I found a premises in Wakefield, just on the outskirts of Leeds, mm-hmm. which was a freehold building at the time. And I could buy this building, I remember now, for about 350 grand. And I had found, and we probably needed to spend another two or 300 grand fitting it out. And I'd already had a valuer tell me that it was going to be, once fitted and open and trading, it'd be worth 8900 grand. So I found a local bank manager. HSBC. I remember this is back in the days when these guys actually had some degree of local discretion, whether or not he bought into me or he bought into the fact that he was going to be the first bank manager in HSBC to finance a lap dancing club and therefore be able to bring all his customers. I don't know, but whatever it was, it worked out, and he agreed to give me a mortgage to buy the place. And and effectively to remortgage it at the point that it was open and trading.
Yeah.
So I had to put down 150 grand, let's say, deposit.
Yeah.
Against the money he was going to lend me, which left me 50 grand left over to do a 300 grand refit, and I probably also needed to spend 50 grand on legal fees at this point. So I now own a building. The builder's about to go in on day one.
So can I just stop you there? You're not joking.
You were
all in.
Well, I was completely
in the deep end, 50 grand left, and you've got this business that you've got to set up.
So I've got a building in the centre. We've got a building in the centre of town. We own the building at this point. I now own the building, and I've got 50 grand left to go and do a 300 grand refurb. So the builder started, and I felt I'd be able to convince them to give me a bit of extra credit. Yeah. And I think ultimately it was a combination of the fact that I sweet talked them into giving me a bit of extra credit, and they were also so deep in at that point that if they.
I thought you were going to say you made them VIPs.
I think that goes without saying, but they were so deep in that they had to finish a project as well. And ultimately, 6, 7, 8 weeks down the line, we finished a refurb, done a fantastic job. The premises opened. Our bank manager, true to his word, gave us the refinance, which gave me the money to pay off the builders, and we then had a premises. We didn't owe anyone any money at that point, obviously, other than the bank, and the business just hit the ground running, really. I have to take some, if not most, of the credit, because ultimately it was my brand, my plan, and my everything. Yeah. But I also do think that the fact that it was probably the right place at the right time in an economy that was becoming more and more liquid, and lap dancing also at the time was becoming, when I use the word socially acceptable, I do so with a
yeah.
degree of pinch of salt, but from the kind of late 90s to the early 2000s, it went from being less of a seedy activity to more that
fun,
one
genuine
entertainment value, where guys would happily go with the girlfriends on a night out.
I went to one on my stag do. My bachelor's told my wife openly, she said, "Hope you had a good time."
So it worked for us. So Wakefield opened, it did well, and then really the business journey over the next 3, 4, 5 years was that I wanted to scale it, I wanted to open more. My bank weren't able to give us any more money at that, from that point, because we'd outgrown his local discretion, and funnily enough, you know, head office credits for HSBC weren't the greatest fans of lap dancing bars, and I got introduced to what we'd call in today's world an alternative lender. A finance broker came in, said, we can refinance your air conditioning, we can refinance your fridges and freezers. I didn't really understand what he was saying, but he gives me some paperwork to sign, sends me 20, 30 grand to the bank. He's like, we now own your freezers, but you can rent them back off us, but I've got my capital back. I'm like, happy days. And that was my first entry, if you like, into asset finance, into asset-backed lending, learning creative ways to leverage your balance sheet, leverage your assets.
I'm so inspired right now. I feel like I need to leave this hot tub and get to work. Honestly,
but then really I just met more and more funders like that, and over from 2004 to 2008 we had 10 trading wildcats, or Walker Wildcats. We had 10 trading venues from Blackpool at its highest point down to Bristol at the lowest geographic point in the UK. And the final club we opened, and a couple of the venues we took over were Experiment Rhinos, there's a very important business lesson in this as well, and that Spearmint Rhino are an absolutely prolific success in the US.
I didn't know that.
Oh, unbelievable. I mean the size and scale of their venues and the money they take is phenomenal, but the US is a very, very different market to the UK. It's funny, I was actually recording an advice interview for someone last night about cultural differences and staying true to your brand, etc. So as I'm telling this story, I realise I'm almost contradicting myself, but not. In the US market, the US in general, things are a lot more spread out. So if you ever go to the US, you'll find that bars and clubs and things in the US are, you can have one there, one 6 miles down the road there, one 3 miles down the road there. Yeah. And the culture of the country is that they're prepared to drive to all these different premises. And that is just not how the UK works. You know, my simplistic explanation for the UK is, we have very defined leisure circuits, and you've got your Wetherspoons, you've got your Yateses, and if you're 200 or 300 yards further away from a Wetherspoons or a Yateses, you're probably off the beaten track and in a niche destination. And in the olden days, that didn't used to matter for things like lap dancing clubs or gay clubs back then, or any of these niches, because they were niches that people were prepared to travel far afield from. Yeah. I mean, using the gay nightclub market or bar market as an example, I mean, you go back to 94, 95, 96, there might be one gay club, which was hidden somewhere, and probably no one particularly talked about going to it. But you look at where we're at now. Major cities, even not so major cities, have very defined, like the gay circuit or the gay quarter,
the strip.
And for me now, if you're far from that strip, if you're off the beaten track, then you're going to have a very tough time getting your people through the door. And Spearmint had come to England very aggressive and arrogant, I think, with their mentality that we're Spearmint Rhino, we know better than anyone what's going on, and they took a lot of premises in a lot of towns and cities which were either secondary locations or the economics were never going to work. So the first venue I bought after I'd opened Wakefield was I bought a failing Spearmint Rhino in Harrogate. But when I say failing, it had a reasonable level of turnover, probably 80%, 70 to 80% of what the maximum of that turnover was ever going to be. It was just saddled with huge overheads, unnecessary cost base, and literally all we did almost overnight was trim that cost base, cut out a lot of theft. There was a big problem with theft,
and like behind the bar and stuff like that.
You know what it is, and again, I guess this is understanding that any potential cultural issues. Any US business is very much built on the tipping culture. I mean, you've been to the States.
Yeah.
Tipping isn't just par for the course. It is very expected. market, and it's really a culture where whatever you want you can get, because everybody tips somebody, everyone kind of backhands someone else. And what happened was basically Spearmint came to the UK, and they have the tipping culture within their US businesses, and they basically instilled upon the management team in the UK that everyone should be tipping each other. And obviously ultimately that really stems down to the dancers and the girls that work there. So the dancers would tip the doorman, the dancers would tip the DJ, the dancers would tip the barman would up tip to the manager. Now, whilst in the US that might be kind of acceptable, in England, for want of a better, it's just weird, you know. And I'm not saying it's right or wrong, but as a UK culture, we don't go dishing out tips left, right, and centre. You know, it's not a gift; it's very much a transaction. So if that girl is tipping the DJ, what is he doing for her in return? Mm. Well, he's probably cutting down the number of times she's got to dance on the pole. Suits her, suits him. Doesn't suit me as an owner who needs the maximum number of girls on the pole at one time. You know, what's the girl doing if she's tipping the doorman? What's the doorman doing in return for his tip? He's probably accidentally forgetting to mark down some of her commission. So, you know, he earns a 20 quid tip and forgets to mark 50 quid of commission. Again, she wins, he wins, I don't win.
Yeah.
And there was literally multiple thousands of pounds a week of gross income, of pure profit, just evaporating in the business because they allowed that tipping culture.
Everyone taking care of themselves except you.
Exactly. And we went in, and again, actually, this ties in with the story I was telling the other night. I went in and said, you know, we are banning the tipping culture. Mm. You know, you are actually, it's not that you're not expected to tip, because they were expected to tip. You are not allowed to tip because it just doesn't work. Obviously, we've got a lot of backlash, you know, and we were told repeatedly, well, that's not going to work, that's not how things are done around here. The reason I tell that story is because I went to 10 or 11 towns and cities across a 4 or 5 year period, and there wasn't a single town or city that I didn't go to where when we opened, we were told, doesn't work like that around here, you know, you need to do things our way or you're not going to last for very long. And I was telling this story last night when a guy was asking me some advice on how he could export his business or import a new business and breach cultural differences whilst maintaining authenticity. And my attitude was, you know, what are you talking about? You know, okay, you're in Blackpool, you're in Leeds, you're in London, but you know, the cultures between all these places are not so wildly different that my brand values will not work in each of these towns. And what I said to this guy last night, what I'll maintain is, if you've got a brand that you believe in, you know, authenticity, honesty, transparency, etc., you know, for me, overcomes pretty much every you know, perceived cultural issue. I mean, look, you know, we can't dispute the fact that, you know, the way the Japanese do business and the way the UK do business is poles and poles apart. But you know, if you're going from Leeds to Liverpool, Liverpool to London, London to Southampton, it's all the fucking same. You know, if you've got a project or a brand or a vision that you believe in, you know, have the confidence to see it through, and don't let the local detract.
That's very interesting, because we were talking about taking London type events to Leeds.
Yes.
So I think you've just answered your own question, which is, if it works in London, it should work in Leeds.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I guess in that particular context, the only difference is are there enough bodies around for that local scale, or can you pull them up? But yeah, so that's basically the end of the good story. It was 2008, 2009. So I was 27, 28. I was at that point the biggest lap dancing operator in the UK. I was having a whale of a time in business and socially. And I'd used the money I was making from that to venture off into other businesses as well. So I then had a chain of retail stores. I had juice bars. I had a small finance business. I was doing everything, but it was all very much over leveraged. When I say over leveraged, you know, knowing what I know now and looking back 10 years, we can talk about it being over leveraged. At the time, it just felt normal. You know, it was my first business cycle, if you like.
Yeah.
And for a lot of the funders who were lending me money, they also hadn't experienced a downturn either. So I just thought it was completely normal that I'd find a business that I wanted to enter or a business I wanted to buy, ring up one of my many funding connections by that point, and they'd just send me the money 2 or 3 days later. And that really was, I mean, that's not an exaggeration anyway, that was the economy that we lived in at that point. What's anyone saying here? Level up, Shelley.
Let's see, let's just read some of the comments here. Wow, I did the same thing on a much smaller scale. I think that came when I was talking about going all in.
We're talking about
my passion, not a lucrative business. Irene says inspiring stuff. That's the same Irene.
From last night, isn't it?
Taking the opportunity to do some strength work in the gym whilst watching you. Thanks for sharing your holidays and stories. This looks so relaxing. Always bringing us very interesting people and stories to learn from. Absolutely, I'll never stop. And just loads of greetings. Cool. Okay, so that's the end of the good story.
That's the end of the good story. We're now in the beginning of 2008, and I more than knew at that point that we needed to find a way to refinance the business from the expensive debt, the short-term debt, the over-leveraged situation that we're in.
Yeah.
And we went off and found two or three larger-scale lenders at that point, one or two of the Irish banks, one or two of the merchant banks at the time, who then expressed interest in refinancing everything, and they basically said, okay, you're a bit small for us now, but if you get to this level and you make the business look like this and feel like that, then we'll refinance you. So I thought, happy days. Went off 6 months later, we got the business packaged up exactly as they needed it. And to give you a hint, this was July 2008, so what was about to happen? Beginning of the credit crunch. We'd gone to these lenders and said, right, we're ready for you. And they were like, lovely, but unfortunately the doors are closed now. We're not lending. So I knew at that point there was no option but to go back to all the funders that we had and basically negotiate some kind of extended terms or some way out of a problem, because whilst we were wildly profitable, we were also, some of the businesses were cash flow negative because we were paying back debt over too short a period, or we had capital expenditure programs where the funding that we had could no longer keep up with it. So I went back to all the funders to basically say, listen guys, I'm not asking anyone to take a haircut, not anyone asking anyone to have a reduced rate of interest, but rather than paying you over 2 or 3 years, I need to be able to pay you over 4 or 5 years or 6 or 7 years whatever it was at the time. And I always maintain that if I'd have had to do this 12 months later, I would have had no problem, because by middle to end of 2009, beginning of 2010, the world and the financial institutions had seen so much carnage at that point that if you offered them 5p in the pound, they'd snap your hand off. But back in my time, I was very much at the beginning of the curve, and I think I had probably about 45 million quid worth of borrowings, which were all personally guaranteed. And I went back to all these lenders, and some of them, true story, Norman, who's staying with us here, I've known him since that day. He was one of the funders who was very supportive of me at the time, and he and we went back to everybody and said, we need this longer to pay you. Most said no.
Can I just stop you there? Sorry, did you say you owed 45 million?
Yeah.
That's how much was still owed, and you had personal guarantee.
Because effectively everything we were building, we were debt financing to grow. So if we opened, a typical nightclub for us back then would be 600 grand to a million quid to open. We had 10 of them, 10 or 11 of them. We also we had other projects in development. We had juice bars, we had retail stores. So also there were some contingent liabilities on leases to have that figure, but this wasn't a black hole of debt. This was debt matched against assets that we were effectively building a capital structure around. So I went back to all these lenders to say, listen guys, we need some extended terms. Some said yes, most said no. It was a matter of really all or nothing. So
how were you feeling then?
I was.
You're very positive.
I was feeling. I guess it was a combination of the fact that I was told by anyone at that point that if you go bankrupt now, you're fucked. Your life's over. Mm-hmm. And again, just to put this into context, from a personal level, as a family, if you like, I was married with a 18-month-old daughter or something at that point, and from a social and egotistical perspective, my life was one of a fleet of cars, houses, holidays, and spending money like it was going out of fashion. So for my own ego and for my family's security, being told that, you know, the only outcome from this is you're fucked for the rest of your life wasn't something, you know, particularly positive. But at the same time, I couldn't really let it bother me because I had no choice but to fix it.
No.
So I went back to all these lenders who wouldn't say yes, convinced some to say yes, some of the other lenders got the other ones to say yes, but we never got to a position where there was enough people, because most of these lenders were saying, we've got your personal guarantee, you'll find a way out of this. I'm saying, I've given 45 million quid worth of personal guarantees, I'm not going to remain solvent, you know, there is a big problem here. Unfortunately, one of the lenders put us into administration. That effectively started a domino block, and literally one thing after another went down, and I got my first demand on my personal guarantee. There was no point fighting it, you know. It was a true demand, and if he didn't get me, the next guy would get me, or the next guy would get me. And in 2008, in September 2008, I was made personally bankrupt. So it was effectively game over, fresh start. But
and you were how old now?
So 2008,
not even 30.
I was 2000. I was 27, 28.
Jeez.
But one, I guess, as shit as it was, I also knew. I say knew. Felt that it wasn't the end, because whilst obviously everyone around was telling me you're finished, it's over, I knew that, you know, having another 30, 40, 50 years of life ahead of me in poverty was not going to suit me. So I always had a very positive outcome to it. And a funny story, I mean, it wasn't for her, but a story I always tell is obviously everything was imploding around us as a family at the time, and I don't know if anyone's ever been involved in a large scale administration or a large scale bankruptcy. Whilst it starts overnight, the aftermath of it doesn't happen overnight. So obviously, if you've got buildings that need to be repossessed, assets that need to be repossessed, it don't just go like that. You know, there's a process where, you know, yeah, where these people are taking them in. And we were probably 6 or 7 weeks into the bankruptcy process, and it was a Saturday night, and I was about to go out for dinner with my wife at the time, and we were. In our kind of bedroom dressing room getting ready, and if you looked out of the window, her car was on the driveway, and obviously I won't say she particularly understood everything that was going on, but she knew it wasn't great. But I guess she was aware, and she knew it. I guess she trusted in me to sort it out, but it's still obviously a stressful experience for other family members, and I remember we were both getting dressed. And she looks out the window, and we're about to drive to dinner, and she looks out of the window. She goes, Matt, quick, look what's happening. We looked out the window, Saturday night, someone's loading a Range Rover onto a low loader to drive it off. And she's like, what the fuck are we going to do? And like I said, we're going to take a taxi to dinner, aren't we? Because, I mean,
you couldn't do anything.
What can you say? And again, you know, the thing I always talk about is not not getting stressed about the things that you can't control. Now, obviously, we all control our financial destiny. Yeah. But at that point in life, that was gone. It was finished. Yeah, that car was always going. You know, whether it went that night or in the next 2 or 3 months, it was just purely a matter of time. There was no way of retaining it. So, what are we going to get stressed about?
Matt, you're sharing so much. I just want to just look at this moment right here that you're talking about. I always ask people, how did that feel? How did that feel to you know, to bring you back to that moment? Like, based on the time that we've spent together, I'm going to assume that, like myself, if I ever have challenges like this happen to me, or like really challenging things, it just makes me want to say, fuck you all, I'm going to show you. Like, how did you feel in that moment, watching the Range Rover getting taken away, knowing that you had to take a taxi, you're in the bankruptcy process?
Probably, though, you know, what you've just said, but maybe slightly less, I guess when I say slightly less aggressively, I mean, I do what I do for me, if you like, not for, you know, it's not competition with other people, or not trying to, you know, earn money to prove something, to show off. Yeah. You know,
so you're not thinking about what people think of you because you've gone bankrupt. You're just thinking, I've got to fix it for me.
Yeah, 100%. I think, you know, one of the most debilitating things we can do is to worry about what other people think about us, because anyone who is is talking shit about us or thinking or getting pleasure from our downfall is a no one that is going to have any bearing or ability to fix my life, and b, being blunt, it's a fucking nobody anyway. I mean anybody whose journey or pleasure in life is talking shit about other people clearly has nothing better to do with themselves. It's easy for me to say, because I guess that's in my character. I'm not pretending that there aren't times when people say things that it does hurt a little bit. It does, but
don't consume yourself with that.
So
Range Rover's getting taken away.
So the Range Rover's taken away, but we still took a taxi for dinner. And at that point, I'd managed to buy, get some work. As a family, we'd bought back certain aspects of the old business. So we still had some income coming in at that point. Obviously, nothing like it was before. But again, whilst we'd had a huge crash, again, I'm not going to pretend that we were on the poverty line. I mean, there was a lot of problems around me. We lived in a family house that, let's say, at that point was worth 600 grand, that had by that point 2 million quid of the mortgages secured against it. so whilst we were still able to live in it, there was still a long-term journey of problems for me to resolve. Of would I be able to come to some kind of arrangement with those lenders to be able to make it a viable option to stay in the house. And again, I guess this is probably an opportune moment to talk about. I often get asked about when is it the right time to give up on something? You've been trying, and when do you give up?
That's amazing.
And for me, there's two almost contradictory, there's not so much contradictory answers, but the short answer is never give up. You've got to have the belief and the kind of patience and the longevity of sight to believe that you are going to ultimately overcome the obstacles and have something worth creating. And unless you're a lottery winner, in the older days, people say unless you're a lottery winner or you become a football player, then there's no way to make money overnight. But as a football player, you've not made money. Literally, inheritance or lottery is probably the only way to make money overnight. As a football player, as an actor or something like that, you've spent years and years and years honing your craft. You as the public might see some new football player who just gets signed at 200 grand a week and thinks he's made all this money overnight. But so I guess going back to when do you give up? If you've got a belief in creating something, then never give up. But you also have to temper that with a dose of realism. And if you believe that the project or the business or whatever it is that you're trying to create, has legs, has the ability to be created, and it's nothing more than putting more effort in, having more patience, and making a few tweaks, then you've got to sit there and battle it out. Because building a business is a multi-year process. Year 2, 3, 4, 9, 10, 15 15 years. So as long as you're seeing, let's say, degrees of small wins, then you've got to sit there fighting it out. Yeah. But if you're not, so if you're going to be realistic about it,
look at the evidence.
Yeah, is it the right project for you? Is it the right business, or should you be moving on to something else? So I guess all the stuff around me at the time was, whilst it felt maybe insurmountable, I had to break it down into let's say bite-sized chunks and say, look, can I fix that problem? You might look and go, well, there's many people look and say, well, that house was worth 600 grand, it had 2 million quid of debt secured against it, I'm going to throw the keys back and walk away. But for me, I knew that with the right conversations, leveraging the right relationships, I may be able to do some financial engineering that would ultimately make it a viable option for us to retain that family home that that we'd had 4 or 5 years in. But like I said, at the time, we then had some income from some other projects. I was doing some consultancy work for people, and my work in life, as you see now and even back then, has never been so much as an operational. I'm not really a day-to-day operator of the businesses. I've always more been about funding, strategy, networking, connections. And obviously, as a newly made bankrupt in the start of the financial crisis, who's just lost his businesses, there wasn't an awful lot of funding, networking, and strategy for me to be doing back then.
We've got some comments coming in here. Fizz Group, Rich Sutherland says, humbling, this really puts things into perspective. Actually, one of the outcomes that I wanted for this time with Matt was to give you perspective. It's certainly given me perspective. Cindy says, attitude is everything. Accepting things that you can't change is vital.
100%, Cindy.
But not always easy. Sunil says, nice meeting place, boss. Watching from India. Hey, Sunil. Guys, please let us know where you're watching from. And once again, if you have any questions, please give Matt a shout through the Facebook platform. Cool. So
at that point, we decided to go on a bit of a holiday slash potentially extended holiday. So my wife, my daughter, went to America. We went to travel. We went with the daughter to Disneyland. You know, a week became 2 weeks, became 3 weeks. Then we started to kind of move around a bit. And I always used to play a lot of poker. And I went to, so we ended up in Vegas, where, you know, back in the glory days, I've been a regular visitor of, and I'm a big fan. I said to the missus at the time, you know, let's spend a couple of weeks here. I want to try and play some poker and see if I can make any money.
Yeah.
And again, 2 weeks became four, became six. I was loving it there.
Living in Vegas.
Well, we were, let's say, 5 or 6 weeks. So at that point, we weren't technically living, but we'd had an extended time there. And my wife said to me, right, come on, we need to now pack up and get back to England. Our daughter Harley, she starts school. She needs to start school in a couple of weeks. To which I said, well, why can't she go to school here? And she's like, looks at me like I'm fucking crazy. And she's like, well, you know, we don't know anyone here, we don't know any schools here. I'm like, well, we don't really know any schools in England, do we, you know? And the next thing, you know, we'd open, you know, gone on Google, open the Yellow Pages or whatever the equivalent was back in 2009 or 10, found a local school near where we were living. And literally 2 days later, signed the daughter up, she starts school there. We signed a 12-month rental on a house. And never really came back. I mean, obviously we're on travelling visas, so, you know, so we dipped in and dipped out. But yeah, but effectively the bulk of our time was in America. Then I remember Harley started school on the Thursday, and it was a birthday on the Saturday. And, like, you know, Jenny and Mum was all not sad, but, you know, thinking, oh, this is going to be so sad for Harley. It's her third birthday. She's in a country she doesn't know. There's no one here that she knows. She's got no friends. And she started school on the Thursday, and I remember going to all the parents in the playground and saying, hi guys, you don't know me, and your kid doesn't know my kid, but it's a birthday party on Saturday, and she doesn't know anyone in America, so we expect you all at the house. And literally 2 days later, we had like 25 kids, 50 parents, and a hell of a lot of burgers and milkshakes catered for. But yeah, I mean, and again, yeah, for me, you know, all my journeys and stories in life is very much one of doing what I want to do, you know, being spontaneous, you know, not letting barriers, you know, yeah, step in your way. And I always say that, you know, if you've got, you know, give me my passport and give me my credit card and I can do anything. And I really think you can apply that to it. And that's maybe, you know, you think it's easy for me to say because maybe my credit card's got a bigger limit, but I really don't mean it like that. You know, if you've got the attitude and the mindset, then there is very little in life that can stop you can get in the way of you doing what you
want. I have doubt that if you had 50 grand, you would look at how you can leverage that 50 grand. At the same time, I have no doubt that if you only had 500 quid, you would go out of your way to look at how you can leverage that 500 quid. And that's a huge, huge lesson here. And I just want to, like, I want to thank you again for this time. It's been so incredibly valuable. And I just want to just leave 2 points again. If you didn't get it, there's been a theme to this conversation. And I'm glad that it's actually two things that I'm already doing in my own life. I can only do it in a lot bigger way. But it's one, being willing to go after what you really want and never settle. And in the process of that, being willing to take huge damn risks. It's very inspiring, man. Very, very inspiring.
So my journey from kind of 2010 to now was really, you know, we stayed in and out of the States for the next 2 or 3 years.
Yeah.
I then at that point split up with my daughter's mom, so she wanted to come back to England. So my daughter came back to school there, and I started to commute a bit between England and America. But obviously it's not, you know, it's quite a long commute, you know, yeah. from Vegas to Leeds. So I decided to come back to the UK. Quite a few of my investors who had been party to what I did back in, you know, 2006, 2007, 2008 were saying, look, come back to England, you know, we want to back you to do some projects. and really from kind of 2012 onwards started to work in the leisure market again. But I think I realised that my heart wasn't in that anymore.
Yeah.
And I loved the finance business. I was doing broking, consulting, bit of investment, anything that was niche in the finance world, really. Because and it was more by accident than by design. Obviously, over the early days of my career, I built so many relationships with niche finance companies that funded weird and wonderful things. That my friends, my acquaintances, my contacts all used to come to me to say, have you got a funder for this, have you got a funder for that? So I was doing it kind of on the side. And then from kind of 2014 onwards, that's really when I guess my Funding Guru brand started. And I guess where I'm at now is that I'm a business lender, but with the mentality that I was a borrower before I was a lender. I'm a businessman, not a banker. And whatever problems you think you've got in business, you've probably learned from that last hour or so story I've been telling you that, believe me, mine are a fuck lot worse than most people's.
Yeah.
If not probably anyone I've ever come into contact with. So we always say to all of our kind of customers or potential customers that it's not just about getting money from me. It's also about getting advice, getting perspective. Maybe getting contacts. And if as long as you're honest with me about your situation, there's nothing we can't overcome. Unless your idea is genuinely a dead duck, in which case I'll be honest to tell you about that as well. And I think as well, that's something that I feel overly qualified to talk about, because when we talked earlier about when is it time to give up,
I'm going to touch on that again.
Knowing what I know now, I should have pulled the plug on the lap dancing business 5, 6, 7, 8 months earlier.
Yeah.
Difference. I never wanted to believe it was over. I felt that if we borrowed some more money from here to plug that hole, or if we did this deal or did that deal, we'd be able to find a way to get out of it. But the honest truth, looking back at it, was we had such an insurmountable pool of debt that without some kind of insolvency process, some kind of more terminal event, there was no way to fix that problem. And I often see this with people who come to me to borrow or to invest in now, and these guys will, let's say, have a business that's in deficit of 500 grand, 600 grand, and they're making 20 grand a year, 30 grand a year, and they want to borrow the 500 or 600 grand. To which I'm saying, this isn't complicated business. This is simple fucking mathematics. If you're making 20 or 30 grand a year, unless something material is going to change in your business, which in most of these examples, even they don't think anything's going to change. They think they're going to be making 20 or 30 grand a year. You need 20 years, 20 fucking years, just to get out of the hole that you're in. And I know there's a big matter of pride when it comes to money and business, and nobody wants that black mark of a CCJ or a bankruptcy or some kind of insolvency event in their journey. But the honest reality is sometimes there is no other potential outcome than that.
I mean, and can I just say, like, if you have a business that you're thinking, man, I'm going to have to bankrupt my business, 10 years later, this man sitting here, uber successful in many, many rights, with incredible people around him. I mean, you've certainly turned it around. And I want to ask you a question. So we've really gone a lengthy amount of time. Actually, let me just read this quickly. Mary says, I'm watching from Ireland. Great story, Matt.
Thanks, Irene, Mary.
Watching from Norway. Cindy says, off to the gym. Thank you for such an honest and inspiring story, man.
Thanks, Cindy.
Your attitude is wonderful. I absolutely agree. I want to ask you, not for me, but on behalf of everyone watching here, to come back to that question, should I continue this or should I not give up? Should I change my strategy? I change my direction? Does Funding Guru, your company or yourself, consult businesses and allow them to make that decision? Because I'm sure there's going to be thousands of people watching this that are thinking, that's exactly where I am right now.
Yeah, I mean, the answer to the question is yes, I do as an individual, or you know, we do as a business. But also, I put a lot of content out there. You know, giving examples, giving my experience of things that have happened to me. Because I think, you know, most business problems aren't rocket science. You know, they just require honesty and often a fresh pair of eyes or fresh perspective. And I think, you know, for the business owner who's been I'm looking at how crusty my face. We've been in this hot tub for like an hour. I'm shriveling up here. But when you're the business owner who's dealing with the problems on a day-to-day basis, you know, it's that old adage of, you know, not being able to see, the wood, yeah, for the trees. And I think, you know, as important as a friendly bank manager in today's world is having the right mentor or mentors around you. And again, obviously, that's something that you guys will be much more familiar with, you know, being followers of JP. But, you know, I'm the first to admit that, you know, mentorship as a concept is something I've only really got into over the last year or two. And I think, you know, and I always say, maybe it's like a British thing that, you know, we don't like to ask for advice. And I mean, if you look at the US market with mentors and personal development, etc., you know, it's huge, and it's part of daily life. And, you know, so many uber successful people, you know, have mentors, have coaches. But whether it's a technical mentor or just someone with a fresh pair of eyes to give you a bit of advice, you know, to look at that business and to look at that problem. But yeah, you know, it's something I do, it's something we do as a business, or it's something you can kind of learn to do yourself from consuming my content. Obviously, I'm always happy to do it. I need paying. It's not always everyone's budget, but, you know, yeah, I'd like to think that I put enough advice out there in general for you to try and be honest with yourself. And if you pick the brains of a few trusted, you know, trusted mates and advisors, you can probably get to, you know, 80% of the answer you need anyway.
Matt, this has been one of the most inspirational, high-value interviews I've ever done, man.
Thank you.
I really appreciate it. And thanks for having me.
I think we've set a precedent now that interviews from now on can only be in hot tubs in fantastic locations. The next time I'm sat interviewing someone in my front
so
room,
boring.
I'm going to feel very let down.
So Matt does plenty of interviews. Matt's actually interviewed me in London. That's how we first got in touch. We really hit it off, and this is the result, us being here. The importance of networking, connecting with people. And I really want to encourage you to connect with Matt. Go to The Funding Guru, go to Matt Haycox on Facebook and Instagram. And if you're stuck in a hard place, or your business is in a difficult situation, make sure you get in touch with Matt and his team. Matt, thank you so much.
Thanks a lot for watching, guys. Thanks for listening. And yeah, hope to hear some of your stories, or I don't hope to hear your problems, but if you've got any problems, I'll look forward to trying to find a solution, and hopefully meeting some of you guys in the future as well.
Take care.
Bye-bye. Speak to you soon.
Thank you for listening to the Matt Haycox Show. For more Matt, check out his YouTube channel. That's youtube.com/Matt Haycox. Or go stalk him on Instagram and Twitter, The Matt Haycox. And we'll see you soon.